Zach, it's Gamera Gong time.
Let me wind up for this one here.
Okay, he's standing up. He's winding up.
Mac, cover your eyes.
Oh man, too late. I'm blinded.
No, you're blind.
Blinded by the gong, as the song says. That was great. I could feel that one, the reverberation from Columbus, Ohio. That was awesome.
Perfect. No, no problem, no problem. I had to get a nice wind up there. I threw out my back on Friday, so I've been, kind of like, stretching to make sure I was good to go for this one.
Okay. Well, yeah, you impressed us.
Thank you, thank you.
If there's any good reason to throw your back out once again, it's hitting the Gamera gong. So we appreciate
It was training for it, I had to get ready for that stuff. But, yep.
Yeah.
Hey everybody, welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum
and Matt Levine.
and we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between, all strange beasts are welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by, this is new, Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing, and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. And speaking of the Zach Pack, we have Zach Linder joining us at camp this week.
Thank you for having me, Vincent. I really appreciate it. And thank you for the new shout out for Zach Linder and the Zach Pack there. I appreciate that. If you do have any real estate needs, I'd love to help you out. I'm based in Columbus, Ohio, so that's where my specialty is, but I can help people all over the country if they need that.
And so, this is mostly an audio podcast, but
Yes, sir.
Zach, you're wearing a great hat right now that says
Thank you.
Zach Pack on it. Where can like the lay person get one of those hats?
Well, so unfortunately, my mom gave me this one, so I'll have to ask her. But no worries, we can protect, get them ordered there. And I don't know if you can see it, but I actually have the actual Zach Pack, which is like a backpack right here. A lot of people think it's a group of people, but it's just me and Zach and the Zach Pack. It's a literal backpack I carry around. It has all the tools I need. It's like a bag of holding. I just pull out magical things while we're on, like looking at houses. Sometimes it really impresses people. They hurt themselves, like, oh, I got a Band-Aid, got flashlights, all the good stuff.
Wow, nice.
Yeah.
The true origin of the Zach Pack. Cool.
I do follow the Zach Pack on Instagram, and Zach, you're always posting really helpful advice about buying a home, home ownership, those types of questions that I think a lot of first-time home buyers struggle with. I know I did. So yeah, they're pretty easy, digestible bits of content you got there.
Yeah, I try to keep it simple, real 60 seconds or less for most of them. And going for more education thing, I follow Mr. H here, who does a great job with teaching, kind of following his inspiration, trying to teach the masses and go from there. So
Can I ask though, is Bandits Emporium still a place where we can buy Camp Kaiju t-shirts?
it definitely is. Yes, Bandits Emporium is still around. They are not sponsoring this season, unfortunately. It's now the Zach Pack, but I hope to get them back in the mix here soon. I'm looking to hire someone that can run it more full time. Unfortunately, I've turned more to the real estate stuff, so it's still going, but it's mostly just the automation right now. But I'd love to get someone in there that can really take it to the next level. Hopefully we can do that in the next 6 to 12 months. But it is still running currently for all the Camp Kaiju shirts, but I'd like to get like a full-time artist and all that good stuff eventually. Yep.
Yeah. All right. Well, links in the bio for the Zach Pack and Bandits Emporium. I'm gonna miss the old Bandits Emporium copy here.
I mean, you're still welcome to say it for free if you want to, but hopefully I'll get sponsored again next season. No problem there. Got to sell a few more houses first.
All right.
Thanks for hanging out, everybody. Thanks for listening. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. Please do so. We're always grateful for that. And of course, please send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com. We may read them out during the podcast, as you'll find out later in this episode.
You can also get in touch with us and find links to past episodes and extra reviews that we're typing up on a weekly basis at campkaijumoviereviews.com. All right. Well, it is also Kai July here at Camp Kaiju, a very special month where we do try to focus our efforts on traditional kaiju. Clearly, with Cloverfield, it's not just the Godzilla universe we are enjoying, but we do have some Godzilla titles coming up this month and some others thrown in there. Matt, what do we have next?
So the second Godzilla movie, Godzilla Raids Again from 1955, only a year later than the original Godzilla movie. So Toho Studios put that into production pretty much right away after Godzilla was a big hit. So yeah, numbers one and two going back to the start, Godzilla and Godzilla Raids Again.
Nice. And then July 31st at the Heights Theater in Columbia Heights, Minnesota, we will be enjoying a 35 millimeter showing of the original King Kong. So we're hoping our friends in the area can join us for that. And maybe before or after we can get a group together and talk about that movie. So, hey, stay tuned.
Yeah, to be determined on that event, but yeah, hopefully we'll do something fun for that.
So before we get started into our main discussion here, I want to talk about some festivals, if I may, some film festivals. So I have some friends I went to college with, I keep in touch with. They're out in LA, they're independent filmmakers, and they have a horror movie with a monster bent that has just premiered at the Chattanooga Film Festival, and it's called Tearsucker. And I'm looking at their Bloody Disgusting highlight on bloodydisgusting.com. But I believe it is about, it's like a dark, emotional, psychological thriller about, I'll just read it. The lead character, my friend Allison Walter, is an emotionally vulnerable trauma survivor who is desperate to heal and get on with her life. Despite the support of her best friend, Deb, played by Danielle McRae Spiso, another friend of mine, Lily is completely isolated when she crosses paths with a charming stranger, Tom, played by Sam Britton. I don't know him, but I bet he's a cool guy. At the park, she feels hope for the first time in months. Tom sweeps Lily off her feet and invites her on a romantic weekend getaway. However, things take a disturbing turn when Lily discovers that Tom has an unusual appetite for tears and will stop at nothing to get them. So it sounds like a cool movie. I'm only bringing it up because that will be our episode next week on Camp Kaiju. Tearsucker is currently streaming on demand. Looking forward to it.
Do you think he literally like sucks the tears out of their eyeballs, or is he just like collect them?
I hope he sucks them out of their eyeballs.
That's kind of how I picture it too.
That title is a letdown otherwise.
Yeah.
No, that's a cool synopsis. I'm intrigued for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like they're doing really good stuff. So I'm happy for their success. Oh, and Camp Kaiju, I recently got an email saying that our podcast is an official selection in the Minnesota Web Fest, which is an internet festival featuring podcasts, but also web series and sort of like internet media like that. I submitted our Jaws the Revenge episode for consideration, and hey, we got selected.
Excellent. How many people are you competing against now?
A lot, but
okay. Hey, it's got to start somewhere.
Yeah. I didn't even know that. That's a pleasant surprise to me. That's cool.
I did it way back in February. Didn't think anything of it, you know, and I still don't know much more than that. I don't know. I'm waiting for more info, I guess.
We'll have to start campaigning.
Yeah. You definitely will. I'm sure this, you guys already know it, but I think the quality of your podcast is amazing. It's just going to take one or two of those things to hit big and you guys are going to blow up. So I'm 100% confident in that. Glad you're entering all these festivals and stuff. So definitely keep doing it.
Thanks, Zach. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
That's very encouraging.
We certainly try. Let's get, yeah, we're figuring it out, bumping out the bumps, ironing out the bumps, the wrinkles. How out, you know, maybe you can cut that out. You know what I mean? Case in point, I guess.
Perfect.
Okay, let's get to our main feature tonight. We are talking about the 2008 motion picture known as Cloverfield. And Zach, you tell us your personal history of this film.
So I love shaky cam footage in general. I don't know if you remember when we were younger, kind of growing up, Marble Hornets was kind of like my first introduction. It was like that internet web series, felt very real at the time. And Blair Witch was a big one kind of in the Orlando area. And so when Cloverfield came out, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I love that the monster was only briefly featured in it. It was more about the experience of what was happening around the monster. I thought that was pretty cool. I was a fan of it when it originally came out. Honestly, I hadn't thought of it too much in the past couple of years, but then my wife's a fan of your guys' show, and she used to actually work at Blockbuster. And so when the show came out, she was working at Blockbuster. They gave everyone like Slusho t-shirts, which as some sort of big Easter egg within the movie. And so she was just a huge fan of it in general, really loves J.J. Abrams, all that stuff. And so she's a fan of Camp Kaiju as well. I was like, hey, when are they going to do this movie here? And I was like, well, let me talk to Vincent and see if we can get it done. And we got it arranged here. I'm very excited because I hadn't revisited the film in a number of years. And while I remembered a lot of it, it was definitely different than I recall it being. There was a lot of elements that are sort of shifted. Now that I know some of the actors, how they've progressed throughout time, I feel like it made it a little bit funnier to me personally and all that good stuff. So really enjoyed getting this one back in the forefront there.
So I saw this movie when it first came out. So that was 15 years ago at this point. I remember liking it okay. I like thinking back that far, which I mean, can't believe that was 15 years ago. But like, I liked it, but I had some reservations, although I can't quite remember what they were the first time around. Revisiting it 15 years later was interesting. Like you said, Zach, like it definitely you notice a lot more, just like, I've changed, of course, and like the movie scene has changed and all that. So I felt like I liked it less this time around, but we'll get into the why in a little bit.
I also saw it at the theater. Zach and I went to high school together. So I know we probably even saw it together. I don't
know. Might have. I don't remember
that, but I remember being caught up in the hype for it. Mm-hmm. And I still think that is so unique to this movie that it like successfully pulled off this multimedia marketing campaign. We'll get into that more, but I was caught up in the conspiracies, like looking at the different frames and trying to put the puzzle together. Mm-hmm. What is a Slusho t-shirt? All that sort of stuff. But I had not seen it since then. And I think that's interesting that it didn't have any like overt sequels. Mm. You know, there are sequels, but not in the same way. And I think that is also unique in this current movie landscape, for better or for worse. But I was excited to revisit it, and I'm very excited to talk about it now.
So on the note of the direct sequel, would you consider that new Netflix series part of the universe, or is it all just kind of, you know, loosely touched to each other?
What's it called? The Cloverfield
Paradox. And basically the idea is that people and like created some sort of space rift, and it's what threw the monster into this universe. And they're all supposed to be like a multiverse situation. I don't know. I'm not that into it, but I was reading up a little bit.
I haven't seen it yet. It's on my list. I just watched 10 Cloverfield Lane. Mm-hmm. Have you guys seen that?
Yeah.
That was the one with where they're like underground and there's aliens at the end, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, then.
Very different movie.
Very different.
I was very impressed with personally. Mm. And we could talk about that sequel too later if we want, or now. It's all good.
Let's do it at the end because I'm not that familiar with it.
I'll just add for right now that I like the sequel a lot, 10 Cloverfield Lane, right? I always get the title mixed up. But yeah. I have not seen the Netflix series yet, so unfortunately I can't really speak to that. But yeah, I like that 10 Cloverfield Lane is kind of a spinoff of Cloverfield, and I like that it's style is just so radically different. Like it's like kind of minimalist and spare a little bit, you know. I guess you could say that Cloverfield is kind of minimalist in a certain way, but like in a very different way, obviously. I like that 10 Cloverfield Lane kind of tries to do its own thing and is like not just like a money grubbing sequel or whatever. So I admired that about it.
Yeah, I was thinking about the shaky cam footage. It's like very much of its time, like very rooted in the 2000s. If they try to do 10 Cloverfield Lane like that, in that style, it just may not have worked because we're like, well, we're over that. We're like, we're done with that fad. It'll definitely come back at some point, but not yet.
Yeah, I think it kind of speaks to my personal subjective tastes, but like the sort of like neat, like well-prepared compositions of 10 Cloverfield Lane is way more up my alley than the shaky cam footage in Cloverfield. So I do think personally I kind of prefer that, but certainly Cloverfield is trying to do like interesting things with the whole found footage gimmick and the shaky cam and all that. So very different movies. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get into a very quick plot synopsis. For those of you who have not seen Cloverfield, it concerns a group of New Yorkers, young 20-somethings, who are enjoying a going-away party for a mutual friend. Little do they know that they will soon face the most terrifying night of their lives as a creature the size of a skyscraper descends upon the city, leaving death and destruction in its wake. Using a handheld video camera, the friends record their struggles to survive as New York crumbles around them. So, yeah, lots of twists and turns in this movie, all through a first-person point of view.
And one thing that I appreciated with it, like that early story, it made me, like, not that it was amazing, but it made me forget that it was a horror movie for like the first 15 or 20 minutes. So like when the actual like situation hit, it genuinely surprised me, which I felt was a little surprising knowing that I knew it was coming, right? And so I don't know. I usually feel like they have really lame opening sequences in horror films, and this one I felt it did a good job with that. So I'm not sure what it was about it, but something about it just seemed like a very believable plot, and I was just invested in the maybe a little bit of a love story, but mostly just the friend antics, all that good stuff there.
I agree. I felt the exact same way, and at one point I had to pause just to see like how far into the runtime we were still at this house party. Right. It's 20 minutes before the Cloverfield monster attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that for a short, the movie already has a short runtime, to invest that much into a setup.
Right.
I think they pulled it off.
I do not like the characters in this movie very much. Mm. Sorry to say it so bluntly, but I think the movie does a decent job of trying to like portray their relationships and their backstories. But like the first thing we see is like, is it Rob or Jason? I think it might be Jason, because then he hands the camera off to somebody else. But Jason is in like this really nice New York apartment that's like overlooking Central Park. And he's like, oh, I'm here because like it's my dad's place and he's out of town. And I feel like this entire group of friends is like, you know, privileged 20-somethings who like their dramas really, I don't know, seem kind of standard, like, you know, like the love triangle and like jealousy and like a crush on somebody who doesn't seem to notice you and stuff like that. Like the actors do a decent job, but it's like, and then like throughout the course of the movie, Rob is like fairly insufferable, I think, even though he does like rescue his beloved or whatever, like the, you know, damsel in distress thing or whatever. But I do not like most of the characters in this movie, so that prevented my like engagement a little bit, I would say.
I had a similar note that basically Rob was the only hero in my mind, because I kind of only liked him. And then I guess I like TJ Miller a little bit just because of the comic relief. But there was, you know, like to me, everyone was super cowardly until like the last 10 minutes of the movie, where they kind of turned it on, realized, oh, this is a situation we got to deal with. We can't just take photos and run away and complain about it. But I hear what you're saying. I don't know. I liked Rob personally, but that's fair.
Yeah. Sorry. Not to be too harsh or anything.
No.
I'm like split between you guys, because I did not. I actually hated Rob, but I loved HUD, played by TJ Miller. I found, one-dimensional, but also the only character that I was enjoying, just because he was pretty funny. Mm-hmm. For me. So playing some of these characters, I'm not super familiar with the cast. We have Lizzie Kaplan, Jessica Lucas, TJ Miller, Michael Stahl David, Mike Vogel, and Odette Eustman, just a select cast. I'm very familiar with the select crew, however.
So it was produced by J.J. Abrams, and the other producer was Brian Burke. It was directed by Matt Reeves. His first feature film was the Let Me In, also did Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and War of the Planet of the Apes, as well as Batman. It was written by Drew Goddard, who was, you might know from like Buffy, Lost, Alias, World War Z, all that good stuff. Cinematography was by Michael Bonvillian. And then the music, Roar by the Cloverfield Overture by Michael, forgive me if I say this wrong, Gichino, and the composer, who was a composer of many fantasy films in the last decade there. But obviously the big one being J.J. Abrams, you know, who's all known throughout sci-fi. He was the big name on this, obviously. And I think this was one of his earlier films, if I'm correct on that. So
Yeah, I think so. I think he had directed Mission Impossible 3 shortly before this, but yeah, one of his earlier ones for sure. As a producer. And I like director Matt Reeves a lot. Like, I think in his later movies, he has a really great sense of visual style. I think that's especially true of Let Me In. And I think The Batman has some like really visually incredible sequences. So I like him a lot as a director. If not, you know, I think he like leaves this visual style and this kind of overall aesthetic pretty much immediately after Cloverfield and goes in a totally different direction. And I like his other stuff more, but yeah, it's certainly like a great, you know, like an accomplished directorial debut, I would say.
Yeah. Michael Giacchino, the composer, I specified the only piece he composed for this movie is called Roar, the Cloverfield Overture. It plays over the end credits. Otherwise, the music in this movie is rather diegetic. It just happens within the world at the party, really. Because then once chaos happens, there's no music happening.
I have a question slash comment about Michael Giacchino. He's been a music composer, soundtrack composer for a long time, but I think he recently made his directorial debut and it was a monster movie. Is that right? I think you've seen it, Vincent.
Werewolf by Night, the Marvel Disney short. Pretty good, actually. Pretty solid for, you know, a debut. I think he's got a good sense of genre. Like, he knows, okay, this is a monster movie. There are certain rules we have to play within. He does a lot of scores for every Disney movie, you name it. He probably did the score for it, including Lost, not Disney, but he's been working with Abrams for a long time.
It's interesting to note that Cloverfield really doesn't have a lot of background music. I didn't notice that until you pointed it out, because I feel like typically horror films, they lean pretty heavily on like good musical cues to set up the tone and the feel of the scene, just kind of subtly. It's kind of sort of interesting that it can carry itself without having that music in the background there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good use of sound effects though. And like, we definitely get a good sense of like the chaos that's going on everywhere. So production started when J.J. Abrams, actually I just read that he was in Japan promoting Mission Impossible 3 and his son got a Godzilla toy. And that kind of inspired J.J. Abrams to want to make his own monster movie. He wanted to make kind of like a uniquely American monster that was different than King Kong, since King Kong is probably like the American monster that everybody thinks about, but he wanted to sort of do like an American spin on Godzilla. So he worked with a concept slash creature designer, Neville Page, who has done a lot of stuff for Bad Robot Productions before. I think he did the monster effects in Super 8 as well, or designed them anyway. And he described it, Neville Page did, as described the monster as a spooked creature with separation anxiety, which I think is kind of interesting. Like, you know, it kind of does seem like just like a flailing infant that's causing all this havoc, you know?
Yeah, I think that is something I have not seen in a big monster movie before. Usually like Godzilla, when he comes ashore, it's, you know, because humans disrupted his home or whatever. But yeah, with the Cloverfield monster, it's just, yeah, kind of just wild. No rhyme or reason.
And I think to kind of go into the expanded lore of the universe, the idea is that it was in a different universe and it was torn into this one. And that just like shows up from its home. Now it's suddenly in New York City. It didn't know it was supposed to be there. It's not like Godzilla that's coming out of the water. It's just, it's there. So I think if you go back to the earlier footage, you like see them at the fair and you kind of just like see it dropping from the sky or something. Maybe that's inaccurate, but I vaguely remember reading something along those lines that you can see it in that earlier footage dropping in from the sky in outer space and stuff. So
yeah, it's one of the last things you see in the film. Mm-hmm. Right in the background, you blink and you'll miss it, but yeah, there's an object falling into the ocean. Mm-hmm. What is it? That was the whole fun, the whole mystery of the movie back in the day.
Presumably it's the monster. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's something else. But
that makes me want to watch the Netflix series, though, because that's a cool idea. And although I do sort of like that Cloverfield does not explain what the monster is or where it comes from, that's a cool kind of mythology or whatever. So I'm kind of excited to see that now.
And one note, I vaguely remember, like, back in the day, everybody talking about how you barely see the monster at all. It's on screen for, like, what, 3 or 4 minutes? But I felt like going through this watch through, I felt like he was very prominently displayed a number of times, like very clearly. I don't know, did you have memories of it just being like a very fuzzy monster with only seeing like little tiny clips of it, or was it always very vivid like this?
I don't
yeah, yeah. Sorry, Vincent, go ahead.
No, I don't I don't rightly recall, actually. You know, it's just one of those movies I saw in the theater, and then 15 years later, I was thinking about it again. Yeah, sure, I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like I felt similar, though, that like the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, you don't really see too much of the monster, but I forgot about the shot. I just watched this movie, rewatched it last night. But like when HUD with the camera is like right underneath the monster, mm-hmm. and it's like looking down like directly at him. And I was like, how did I forget that? Like we get like a clear full view of this monster, right, like in that moment, you know?
Which that was like one of my least favorite scenes of the movie when I rewatched it. I was like, what is even happening here? Why is it targeting him specifically? But whatever, that's a different question. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, to get ahead of ourselves, I did feel like the last, after they get on the helicopter, I feel like I was like, okay, you can wrap it up. They could have just died on the helicopter.
I wish they did.
It was a little unbelievable that they all survived the helicopter crash. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I would have been fine if they had died, because the conceit is that we are watching not a movie, but a real event. So if they died, okay, great. That's how it ends.
Yep.
But then it kept going.
Especially with it being found footage by the military, it would have made sense if it was like on the helicopter there. But I agree with you. I wish it would have stopped just like right there, cut out the last 5 minutes, but that's okay.
Totally agree. Yeah. Alas. I can wrap up the production backstory just real quick. The movie was greenlit in 2007 and then shot later that year. As we kind of already alluded to, it was a very secretive production. There was a lot of speculation in online message boards as to what this monster or creature or whatever actually was. Some very cryptic trailers came out. And the first one, I don't think the name of the film was even included. So definitely generating a lot of speculation about that. Even the casting was done in secret, where the actors who auditioned did not read scenes from this script. They read scenes from earlier Abrams productions, like Lost and Alias and stuff like that, because they were trying to keep it so secret. So, you know, the true identity of the film would not be leaked. Just kind of jump into the end here. It was a huge success. I made $172 million on a $25 million budget. I do think this was part of the shaky cam, fake found footage movement or whatever. Like, I think Paranormal Activity, the first one, came out around the same time.
Yeah.
And movies like Wreck, REC, was around then too. So this seemed to be, I don't know if it was like the progenitor, like the genesis of the movement, but it's certainly part of it, I think.
Yeah. Very much of its time. It's, I think... Yeah, watching this movie, I was transported back to the late 2000s with the dress and all the cell phones, that those types of things instantly put a movie in a time and place. The fact that he's not even using a cell phone to record the found footage, you know, he's having a camcorder.
Right.
Which is fine. Like, it didn't distract me. It just made me think of the movie as a bit of a time capsule. And I found that very curious. Where was I going with that? Oh, and then tying it into the early days of the internet in terms of social media, this was before even Facebook was like the dominant force. I saw that the characters in the movie had MySpace profiles. So that tells you when this movie was made. And I just feel like, the same type of like marketing strategy wouldn't work as well today, because I feel like today's social media landscape is so, there's so much noise, mm-hmm. and it's like, how do you cut through that?
Yeah.
And shaky cam is almost the standard now, with everyone just having their own personal hand cams and everything like this. You know, I don't even know if you'd call it that anymore. So.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because, like, even though this came out relatively recently, only 15 years ago, like, it does feel like a totally different time. And as we'll probably talk about, just kind of like the post 9/11 fears, like, I feel like this is fully in that time period as well, you know, like, and whereas, like, right now, I think that's, you know, the same kind of like ubiquitous concerns about terrorism and like attacks on American soil or whatever are not quite as prevalent. So yeah, just like a product of a different time for sure.
Yeah. Before we get more into those themes, I want to read our new sponsor break. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. And what do you know? It's time for Mina's Mailbox. We have, this is our opportunity to read some of our listener comments. So if you out there listening have any questions about monster movies, thoughts about monster movies, or about Camp Kaiju, how do we do things behind the scenes, or telling us your favorite Godzilla movie, let us know on Instagram or campkaiju@gmail.com, and we'll feature it. So this one comes from Naomi_Osborne from Instagram, and she asks, are all kaiju monsters and films a metaphor for nuclear weapons and war?
It's a good question.
It's a good question.
It is. Yeah.
On the surface, I totally see what Naomi means. Matt, disagree with me if you want, but I feel like almost every kaiju movie we talk about, it sort of is the same themes. Okay, atomic anxiety. We get it. Especially movies from the 50s.
Yeah, I think you're right about movies from the 50s for sure. Certainly exceptions come to mind. Like, I'm thinking of The Untamed, that Mexican movie that we talked about like last year here on the podcast, which comments on, you know, homophobia and like lust and kind of like this sort of sexual repression of society and stuff like that. So, yeah, like not all of them are about like nuclear war and all that. But like, I think monsters are such powerful, like metaphorical things. Like, they could stand for almost anything that you want them to. Like, they are a great device for any kind of like social or political theme that you want to bring into it. And definitely in the 50s, that would have been nuclear war.
Yeah. Cloverfield, for example, I wouldn't say is about war per se, but it does, I think, represent the post 9/11 fears that Americans were feeling only 7 years after 9/11. So thank you, Naomi, for dropping us a line. We hope to hear from you again soon.
I definitely felt like that initial scene right when they go out on the street, right before the, like, the Statue of Liberty comes in, they have like that giant dust storm, and then everybody kind of is just walking through the street kind of in a daze. That definitely had very post, like, tower collapsing, like immediately after the dust cloud imagery to it, that felt like it was almost pulled exactly from like a news clip itself. So definitely could feel that New York targeted, you know, trade center coming through there. I felt like, at least.
Yeah, for sure. I think the imagery of the Statue of Liberty's head, like mm-hmm. decapitated and just like lying in the middle of the street or whatever, is a very powerful image. Like, you know, maybe like probably even more so than the World Trade Center, like the Statue of Liberty is synonymous with New York and maybe with America. So yeah, I think that's like powerful. It's a powerful moment and a powerful image in the film for sure.
And funny that immediately after it happens, people are taking pictures of it and kind of just ogling around, which I do think is accurate how it actually happened. Like, the danger settles for just 30 seconds. Like, oh, we're safe now. It's okay. Let's go take pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that I commented on that as well, because I feel like, and Zach, you alluded to this earlier, today we take it for granted that everyone is filming whatever tragedy is happening. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I feel like Cloverfield precipitates that just right ahead, right before the like smartphone revolution. So in a way, that doesn't date it. And I'm like, this feels more real than ever, actually. Mm-hmm. And I'm watching it, and I was quite affected by the 9/11 imagery coupled with the found footage. It made the movie feel very grounded in a way that a more formal presentation may not have been able to tap into as much.
I would agree with that, but I think that's also why I don't really like the character of Rob very much, because he's like, yeah, he is very heroic. He's like, I'm going to like ignore what all these soldiers and everybody else are telling me and go like right into the heart of the city to rescue this one woman who he's in love with for sure, but like maybe she doesn't feel the same way. They're like, what, 22 or 23? Like, I just feel like it's not really very, very realistic that this guy would like be this sort of like selfless hero. And that kind of clashes with like what the movie is trying to do otherwise, where it is trying to have that more like grounded aesthetic, you know, and like what might actually happen if something like this took place in New York City. If you had this guy like Rob, who's just like, you know, I'm like a knight in shining armor. Like, I did not buy it. So that's like a big obstacle to me for this movie.
That's right, fair.
I couldn't agree with you more, honestly. Yeah. And that's where the movie, like, oh, it's like, oh, you could have been like a truly, like, I never felt emotionally invested in the characters. Now, Matt Reeves does a lot of things with the camera and the editing that makes me very excited. And I'm like, whoa, I'm in this world. But in terms of staying power, yeah, I was with you. I was like, Rob, like, you're killing me, man. You're going to climb a building, a skyscraper, probably like 50 stories tall for a chick you know is dead. Now, I mean, come on.
And like force your friends to do it too, you know, like he doesn't force them, but he doesn't really try to dissuade them very much.
And,
you know?
And it's not that somebody couldn't do that in real life. Right. But I didn't believe their relationship. You know, they had the conversation on the fire escape during the party where it's like, oh, man, you got to go for her. You got to like follow your heart. And I was like, but as an audience member, I don't like they broke up. They're done. Maybe they should have been still together. Maybe they should have been like newlyweds, right? If they were newlyweds, maybe I could believe it a little bit more.
Yeah.
So it was just something like that in the creative choices.
If I could push back a little bit though, because I don't think they broke up. See, what the plot was, they were friends the whole time. Then they finally realized they liked each other, banged one time. And then it went to the situation where like, oh, I'm leaving. We can't get together, blah, blah, blah. So that is the idea of future hope that drives him, right? It's not the past relationship. It's am I missing the thing I always loved and knew was there? Because we were friends for all these years. The spark finally lit and I'm leaving immediately after. So I don't know. It was the idea of potential that I feel like drove him. The idea that he was leaving behind his true love, even though he didn't know it was that necessarily. So that's I kind of bought into it a little bit more, maybe because of that reason. But
and I don't disagree with you.
Mm-hmm.
Had this apocalyptic scenario not happened,
mm.
by all means, Rob, go follow your heart. But I don't think that feeling is more trumps the you know monstrous Holocaust that is descending upon their city.
That's fair.
But yeah, I mean, I'm all for true love. Why not?
Yeah, I would buy what you're saying, Zach. But I also like picture, you know, like what might have happened like 6 months after this movie takes place, where like Rob and Beth, is that her name? I think her name is Beth. You know, maybe they're together for a couple months. And then like if this movie were to take place like 5 years later, they would find other Tinder matches and just like break up immediately. You know, like that's what I imagined what took place like almost immediately after this movie happened.
But it wouldn't affect you when she calls you on the phone and you're on that bridge and like you hear kind of like, help me, I'm not dead, please come back and save me. Like that to me is what got, it's like if he was just choosing to do it, that's one thing, but she called him and said I need help and he could barely hear it, so he knows the potential's there, and she's the one who reached out to him like in her darkest moment. She's the one he thought of
or okay
in that. So
I'm glad you brought that up. Mm-hmm. I missed that completely. I thought he was going out there on a whim to like to see if she was still alive.
That's right.
Knowing that she called him. Thank you. That was my bad. But you know.
And he's sorry.
It's a good point. Yeah, for sure. I think if I just liked these characters more, like if we knew anything else about them other than the fact that like they're rich and they're in New York, like then maybe I would like care a little bit more about what happened to them, you know?
Now I will say I was a hair more invested in HUD and what's her name's relationship. I found that intriguing. Mm. That he's like slowly wearing on her, right? He's doing the cheesy lovable goofball thing. She's coming around to the idea, and then she explodes like a zit, and that was heartbreaking. I was like, oh damn.
It didn't make a ton of sense either. She's I think the only one that blows up in the whole film, if I recall correctly, but that's okay.
It is a shocking moment for sure.
It was.
It's hard for me to like, not really any of the characters in this movie are too convincing. Again, not to be too harsh on it, but like, I don't know, maybe it's because of like TJ Miller. He's kind of become a little bit more well known since this movie came out. And I feel like it's kind of like a similar sort of like lovable idiot sort of like character that he's played before, you know? So I don't know. I see all these characters as types, but not really as people. And that also kind of limited my engagement a little bit.
For sure.
He was definitely his normal guy from every single show. Like, that's why I think I enjoyed it more. So, I'd already built up all these other characters. Like, you just put, you know, the guy from Silicon Valley right in the middle of the apocalypse. That makes sense now. And it just added a lot of comedic value to me. But I think 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it wouldn't have that same comedic value just because I didn't have all the character, the actual actor build up there. So,
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So, Matt.
Yeah.
You love the form and aesthetic of this movie, right? Like, if you could, all your movies would be like this, right?
Oh man, that would be a cinematic nightmare for me. So the first note that I have on our Google Doc is, this is a combination of many things I dislike visually in movies. That's probably why Vincent is saying that. You know, again, I don't want to be too hard on it because there are things that I like and I'll get to them in a minute. But like, yeah, it's true. I don't like CGI. And I know that like this movie probably couldn't have really done it any other way. But still, I think it's kind of disappointing that that's so clearly how they're achieving the special effects a lot of the time. But yeah, probably more so for me, it's like the found footage, like shaky cam aesthetic. I generally don't like that very much. And I think it's when I watched 1917 recently, which I rewatched. And there was another movie that was kind of made to seem like it's all one shot. But now, of course, I can't remember what it was. But like, even like that kind of thing is like technically impressive, but I feel like most of the time it doesn't actually lead to like more powerful imagery or like more beautiful imagery. Like, it's kind of just like, yeah, you did a lot of planning and choreography, but like, I don't know if that really helped like the visceral sort of like reaction to the movie or whatever, you know? So maybe I'm kind of like a stubborn purist or whatever, but I like it when filmmakers and cinematographers like, you know, carefully think out like the best way to convey a scene. Like, they set up the camera, they edit between various shots, all that stuff. Like, I think there's a reason that that is like the language of cinema or whatever. And like, you know, certainly something like Cloverfield or like the found footage shaky cam one shot movies are like an impressive stunt. But for me, they usually don't rise above that level, you know?
Well, I think about, you know, that's just realism. And you can talk about it with the theater too. The fact of the matter is, real life is boring, and it's not, and movies are make-believe, and we want to be taken to another world. So I think, yeah, I think you run the risk of when you portray real life, like, it is kind of is what it is, and you go home and you go, okay, well, I never transported to another place.
And I think when you're, sorry, just to kind of clarify what I meant a little bit, like, I think like when you try to do that sort of realistic effect where it's mimicking like the way we actually move and see and stuff like that, but then you have this stuff that is clearly fantastical, like obviously the monster in Cloverfield, or even just like Hard to Buy, like Rob and the characters themselves, like that contradiction and that clash like never really works for me, you know? Like, I can't believe this is actually happening if like I don't like the characters and don't think they're real people and stuff like that, you know? So like, yeah, it's like an admirable attempt, and I like the I can see the thought process behind it, but for me, a lot of the time, it doesn't work.
Well put. I liked it more than you did. No, but I understand what you're saying. I think for this type of like monster movie, you know, I really gravitated to the sense of chaos that it creates, and I found myself lost in the melee. I liked, and I'm going to credit Matt Reeves, the director, for these like very quick, specific images that I found very frightening. They're down in the subway and it's dark and they turn on the night cam. And that was a moment where I went, oh, I remember what happens. And that, see, that was an image embedded in my subconsciousness from 2008. And I was like, oh God, that's right. And I found those moments really effective.
That's my favorite part of the movie. Yeah. Agree.
I guess going for mine there. So the aesthetic, I think in general, I've gotten really used to this kind of found footage style, just because I spend so much time in the social media space. This feels like, like you kind of commented earlier, Vincent, just like the normal thing nowadays. So I think it hit me as more real because I'm so used to seeing that now. But I think also it helped not seeing it on a big screen. I think I might've gotten a little sick if that was like my entire field of vision versus just a smaller screen there. So I think that really impacted the viewing experience. That's what's maybe hard to appreciate a little bit, some of it, but much like you commented, I felt like it was, had a lot of scenes that where I was surprised, and it didn't feel like you were running and shaking the whole time. Like, I felt like there was scenes where they would just like sit down in a spot on the street and like the camera would more or less stay still, and here are the soldiers coming, here's the action happening around, and then we're going to move again, and then it stops and it gives you more action. So I think they could have been constantly moving and they chose not to, and I think that was a good choice personally. But there was a couple of scenes where it was definitely chaotic and disjarring, and I could see myself getting sick if that was the only thing I saw.
I'm going to dovetail off of that into the good, the bad, and the campy. So something that I liked about this movie were those moments where the camera stood still. And I don't know, but I'll credit Matt Reeves again in just like knowing when to take moments to breathe and just like let the characters relax and we can reflect on what the hell we just saw, and like finding those moments, I thought worked really well. I'll leave it at that. That's my good.
Zach, you can go first if you want.
You first, please.
I mean, like, I've dwelt a little bit too much on the bad, so there is some good stuff that I like in this movie too. I think, like, yeah, like the choreography and the camera movements when like something does suddenly appear, there's the good moment with the night vision in the subway, but also when they're in a stairwell and one of those like big insect things suddenly just like drops down from the ceiling, that's another really great moment. So I think at its best, this movie does combine like a kind of you are there like immediate aesthetic with like everything going nuts really well, and it's very effective when it's able to do that.
And one good thing I really loved was that the authority in the film, so like the soldiers and the government officials, they didn't gatekeep people from moving to the next area. I always hate in films where they got to sit there and argue with some arbitrary soldier for like 10 minutes to be able to leave the compound. I was very thankful they were able to just go. That was a great choice. That is how I think it would be an emergency. It's like, you want to go into the middle? Go for it. Have at it. And that was a very nice picture.
Yeah. So. That soldier was like, I don't have time for this. You want to go? Go for it.
That soldier even tells him like exactly where to go. He's like, if you want to rescue your girlfriend, she's probably on this exact street corner. All right.
Yeah. So something I didn't like about this movie, I already talked about it. I could have invested. Well, them not dying in the helicopter was a bit too much for me to, suspend my disbelief for. But I just could have, you know, invested more in the Rob and Beth relationship, because we even end the movie on them and it just feels so melodramatic. Like, I love you. I love you too. And it just, I don't know. It rang hollow. And then they got blown up.
That definitely was mine too. Except mine was like 2 minutes before, when they had TJ Miller's character like turn around and there's the monster above him, and then he gets singled out and eaten. And in my head, I was like, one, why is the monster even there? Like, I thought he was in the middle of the city 2 seconds ago. And then two is like, this giant thing is going to single out a singular human for no real reason, eat them, and then just move on. Like, that killed me. I wish they would have just died in the crash and ended the movie right there. 5 minutes and it was good to go. But that's
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Agreed. Totally agree. Yeah. I think like the Rob Beth relationship, it kind of like calls back to that with like the jump cuts and like the tape that's already in the camera or whatever. Like, it flashes back to this earlier date that they had where it's just like, you know, they're having a good time and they're getting to know each other and stuff like that, which in theory is a good idea. But I just feel like it's not like they should have spent more time on that to like convince us of that. You know, I think like little blips here and there where, yeah, the dialogue is pretty trite. Like, I love you. I love you too. Like, that's not enough to really make us care for them, I think.
And the scene with the building leaning on the other one and then going up there, that was just very hard for me to get by. I was like, okay, I don't know if it would stand like that and be able to just jump from one side to the other, but that's all right. We'll look past it. It was kind of like the climax too. Like, that was like, oh, it's such a lame climax, but that's all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was that in the helicopter. I went, oh, okay, we're very much not in the real world. This is a movie. This is like The Rock is now in our movie and he's doing superhuman things. Actually, The Rock in this wouldn't be that bad. I have a campy thing. And it was just some, like, it all comes from HUD. I couldn't help but laugh at some of his quips. Beth says, oh, when they're getting Beth off of the skyscraper and she's like, she sees the Cloverfield monster and she's like, what is that? And HUD just very deadpan goes, it's a terrible thing. Just keep going. Just keep. I'm like, yeah, that's honest.
And then they see one of the little insect things. And I think she's like, what the hell was that? And he's like, some other terrible thing.
Yep.
It's a decent running joke, I guess. Yeah, HUD is most of the campiness in this movie, and it's funny sometimes. It's not terrible, but it does kind of detract from like the mood at other times, I think.
Yeah. All right, so let's get down to our final ratings.
Should I read them off as I always do?
It is my favorite part of the show when you read off the criteria.
It's my favorite part as well. So here's our four criteria. Number one, it's a timeless classic and stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time.
Zach, you are our guest. Please take us away.
So I did enjoy this film quite a lot. However, I'm going to give it the second rating there. There may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. I enjoyed the film the second time through. It was definitely different than I remember it. There's some parts I wish were changed, but I think there was a lot of interesting moments that took the culture of the time that seems normal now, but was very weird back then. I think they just happened to predict it correctly. And like kind of knowing that gives it like, oh, you did a good job understanding how cell phones and all that type of stuff would work, how the psychology of it would work. I think it makes sense now. So I think it stands the test of time, a little bit antiquated.
Nice. I can go next. Yeah, I think I agree. I think it stands the test of time. I think there are some missed opportunities with the characterization. But as a whole, I found myself riveted by what was happening and being really intrigued by the time capsule of it in the sense that like it did anticipate what we now take for granted. So I think it's very interesting to watch. Yeah, I'd recommend it. And as a monster movie, purely like destroying the city, I think there are some great action set pieces worth watching.
Yeah, I would agree with what both of you said, although for me, it's going to be historically significant or just fun, but it doesn't stand the test of time for me. I do recognize that it's mostly like personal subjective opinion. That's why I don't like this movie as much as you guys or some other people. You know, just like my preferences for like visual style and special effects and stuff like that. So yeah, like it's an admirable attempt. I think it's trying to be like a new spin on monster movies. And for like an American movie in 2008, it does have that kind of interesting time capsule aspect. But yeah, there are quite a few things I don't like about this movie. So I think I'll have to give it our third rating.
That's great. I love it. All right, Zach, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Vincent. Thank you, Matt. I appreciate you guys having me on. It was a lot of fun. Keep up the good work with this. I think you guys are doing amazing things. And I definitely think if you keep at it for another season or two, you're going to be famous in a big kind of way here pretty soon. You guys are doing it too well, too consistently not to take off in a big way. You just need to hit that right algorithm thing and you're going to shoot up the rankings. I know it. So keep it up.
All right. Thank you, Zach.
No problem, guys. Yes, sir.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back sometime.
Thank you, Zach. Definitely.
Sorry, Matt.
I just said definitely. Sorry.
Yeah.
You should keep all this in the final episode, by the way.
Well, thank you all for hanging out. If you liked what you heard, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit campkaijumoviereviews.com Instagram for more monster movie content. We can't thank you enough. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with theme music by Terrence Jackson and Mania's Mailbox by Ben Cook Feltz. Oh, and before I forget, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio.
If you contact Zach's mom, you might get a free hat out of it too. So make sure you do that.
Hey, do you guys remember a couple of years ago when that guy was lighting homeless people on fire in the subway?
Jesus, Todd.
What?
Maybe not the best topic for conversation down here.
Right. I just can't stop thinking how scary it would be if a flaming homeless guy came out of the dark right now.
Seriously.
I'm just saying. Sorry.
What was that?
Let's just keep moving.